rather than spending millions of dollars buying cyber insurance, I think what's necessary is really to enforce the cyber policy as well as the education aspect to make sure that we're reducing the overall phishing to the minimal. We're using the technology to help enhance the overall awareness of phishing.
You're listening to KBcast, the cybersecurity podcast for all executives. Cutting through the jargon and hype to understand the landscape where risk and technology meet. Now, here's your host, Carissa Breen.
Joining me today is David Chow, Chief Technology Strategy Officer from Trend Micro. And today we're discussing zero trust, hype or hope. So David, thanks for joining. It's wonderful that you're back in Sydney, Australia, although it's raining a lot here and it always seems to be at the moment. So yeah, it's wonderful to talk to you again. I know it's been a few months since I have spoken to you. So yeah, thanks for joining the show.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
So David, I want to start with now zero trust. I think when you were in Sydney on the conference last, we discussed zero trust, but then also personal liability. Now, there's a lot of people out there talking about zero trust, maybe even to the point that people's eyes are starting to glaze over. So what do you sort of believe in terms of zero trust? Like, is it hype or what are your thoughts?
To me, it's actually a combination of both. It's hype as well as it's hope, right? So when I was the CIO for US government, I actually leveraged zero trust and really pushed forward on the zero trust concept. I leverage it to have conversation with people that typically do not know cybersecurity. I mean, they don't know IT, they don't know what's going on within cybersecurity. They don't know the impact that a lack of mature cybersecurity could actually impact the overall environment. So I use the concept of zero trust and talk to people, try to educate people and talking to people about that we should not have the necessary trust in people as well as in our technology, but then really enforce the way to make sure that we're checking on everything, we're validating on everything, including our people, including our process within the environment, and be able to move forward to make sure that there's always a check and balance and understanding of the visibility within our IT environment. So that was something that, to me, it's very fruitful to have that discussion, to be able to use a simple terminology so that you actually get people's understanding of cybersecurity. But at the same time, that I think in the past year, ever since the Biden administration talked about zero trust or pushed out this executive order, it has been talked about so much to the extent that vendors are basically using that as a way to, you know, produce profit, right? So to me, that's where the hype comes in, because zero trust actually encompasses across people, process, and technology, and not just on the technology aspect.
So I want to press on that a little bit more. So you said people, process, and technology. And would you say that perhaps there are people out there not really focusing on the people and the process, but more so the technology side of it? Because again, like, you know, what you just mentioned before, it's around, yes, we can't really trust our people, but our technology then as well. Do you think maybe the process part is missing if you were to sort of zoom out and look at the industry on the whole?
Most definitely. I mean, to me, a lot of people would focus on technology because it's something simple. They can invest funding into buying technology. And a lot of times the vendors are doing a good job in terms of marketing the capability. But the bottom line is that in order to have a mature cybersecurity posture within any environment, technology is only one third of the stool, right? There are also two other stools, people and process. People and process actually form the culture of any organization. If you have the greatest technology in the world, but you're not following the necessary process, or your people are not being held accountable or understanding the overall cybersecurity posture and how they contribute to the safeguard of the IT asset, then essentially that you're creating an environment where you could have, you know, privacy data breach, you could have unsecure APIs, upload information into the cloud. So that's where I see that personally, a lot of organizations focuses more on purchasing the technology rather than shoring up on their people and processes.
So why do you think that's the case? Do you think it's because people in the tech realm are technologists at heart, so it's sort of easier to then focus on technology rather than the people and the process? Is that just sort of more intrinsic in people's DNA in this space, or why do you think that's the case?
I think it's a combination of a lot of factors. I'll give you a couple of factors. One is that, you know, so I was the former CIO CISO, and I got to the level, I spent 20 years, finally got to the point that I became the top person within IT organization. Why would I jeopardize my career over something? So if my peers are buying this technology, I would definitely want to buy a piece of technology to make sure that I'm helping to secure the environment. If there is a privacy breach and the privacy breach is resulting in technology, then I want to make sure that I'm shoring up on the technology side. I want to be able to explain to the board. I want to be able to explain my agency head that this is what the industry is using and this is what we have within our environment. So that's the easy aspect of managing the risk from the cybersecurity side. But if you look at it, the hardest part is actually managing human, the psychological part of human element. So everybody's unique, everybody's different. It's very difficult to tell if a person is, you know, would actually constitute as insider threat for any IT environment. It's easy to have the technology to look at your IT assets as zeros and ones. But when you talk about people's mind, you don't know what people are thinking. You don't know, I don't know what you're thinking right now. So essentially that, you know, that's the hard part to manage. And usually people tend to not focus on that aspect. They tend to focus more on things that are easier to control, the technology investment that they can put in, as well as sometimes the visibility to the board that there's a mitigation risk that's being in place by purchasing cyber insurance. But a lot of time, rather than spending millions of dollars buying cyber insurance, I think what's necessary is really to enforce the cyber policy as well as the people education aspect to make sure that we're reducing the overall phishing to the minimal. We're using the technology to help enhance that the overall awareness of phishing, but at the same time that really drive at the root of the people aspect to make sure that we're changing the culture so that each employee understands within any enterprise understands their impact to the cybersecurity ecosystem.
So is what you're saying, David, that nothing draws a crowd like a crowd? So going back to the technology point, if you're, you know, other agencies or other companies are buying X technology, then you're like, so am I. I guess that's how people get rapid adoption. That's how people monopolize the game. Like if you want an analogy would be, I don't know, like Nike sneakers. So all of a sudden everyone started wearing Nike sneakers. Do you think there's a little bit of that mentality in there?
I think so. I think in a way that if my peers are buying this particular vendor and I follow the peers, if something were to happen, I can easily justify to the board saying that, hey, I actually took a poll and all my peers are actually buying the same product. So it's not really that we have product issues. It's really that we probably just need to shore up on enhancing the human element. So I think there's an aspect in terms of reducing risk from the technology angle, but also at the same time, and this is something, you know, this is something that the President Biden recently, you know, early March, actually pushed out another executive order on the cybersecurity national plan for the U.S. And within that national plan, it actually talks about quite a bit in terms of protecting the privacy data, the citizen data. So in U.S., in the past 3 months, there was a major breach in our telecommunication company, one of the largest, T-Mobile. There's 37 million records, privacy records. It was actually exposed through unsecure API. But again, and it goes back to the unsecure API, it's really a lot of time besides having technology to be able to shore up on the defense, but also really enforcing the people and process side to make sure that when people are developing, they're not updating or uploading privacy data, the live privacy data into the cloud. And then they're actually making sure that any information that goes externally, actually there is a process to review. And if it's not necessary, then they will actually discontinue that practice.
So you mentioned before that, you know, human factors, difficulty controlling people because everyone's got a mind of their own. You mentioned before, you don't know what I'm thinking, which is a very valid point. So yesterday I was at some family barbecue and family friend was saying like, hey, KB, you know, he does more like surveillance work. And he's like, so what's stopping one of my employees from like just going and deleting everything that I do? I was like, well, there are controls you can put in place, but technically I sort of get what you're saying. And I was like, well, there's no real way of fully trusting someone. So do you think that that worries organizations? Now, it's okay if you've got one or two people, but when you're growing and you're looking at like a bank or a telco and you've got 50,000 plus employees, like there's probably bound to be a few rogue ones in there. So how do you think from your experience being an executive, you can sort of handle knowing that are people going to do the right thing at the end of the day? How do you sort of handle that, like mentally, but then also in terms of risk, also if you've got a board that you've got to respond to, how does that sort of look?
So I think that's the concept of the zero trust. So you need to treat people that they're not saying that they're not to be trusted, but they need to be validated and verified, right? So you're talking about exactly the situation with insider threat. You could have gone through all the physical security checks. This person could also even pass the polygraph. But the bottom line is that the person's livelihood changed all the time, right? You don't know what's going on. The person could be blackmailed for whatever reasons, or it could be financial hardship for whatever reasons. So that's something that enterprise doesn't have control over its employees. That's where it's critical to always validate and constantly verify that this person is actually accessing the data that he or she is allowed to access and not anything more. That's the overall gist on the zero trust. It's really looking at the data classification assigning to the individuals. And then also for those individuals, whether they're actually who they say they are, and they're able to log in, are they accessing the right information? Are they overseeing additional information that they're not supposed to be looking at? Are they looking to exfiltrate additional information? Those are something that technology can actually help to identify baseline, as well as creating a pattern. And then if there are issues, using technology to help alleviate the situation by going through additional investigation, by involving physical security to have a discussion, personnel security to have further discussion, and then to really understand the root cause if a person is accessing information that he or she is not supposed to access.
Thanks for clarifying that, because I think that is a valid concern for many people. And how could you trust that many people anyway? There's always risk in that people's personal sort of problems going on, which could potentially force them to do things that they don't want to do. So would you say that customers are confused when it comes to zero trust? Now, I ask this because at the start of the interview, there's like a lot of people out there demand zero trust, like even to the point where people are, their eyes are glazing over. So what are you sort of hearing? Because again, if you look at each vendor or each organization, their interpretation of zero trust is a little bit different to one another. But I also think that maybe people, as in customers, get the wrong idea. And what I mean by that is they probably think it's more of a solution rather than like a framework, like you mentioned before, like people, process, and technology. What are you sort of hearing, or what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, so I see a lot of vendor market zero trust as a product or a solution. I mean, that should not be the way to, we should not leverage that as a way to create this propaganda to try to brainwash customers. It's the zero trust concept is really an architecture concept that look at the overall framework from people, process, technology, and how do you mature from that overall concept based on the finite resources any organization have. So in a way that it still goes back to risk management. So I look at cybersecurity as a practice of risk management, but more focusing on the IT side, right? But then we also know that with the latest ransomware, with a lot of the breaches, it's actually creating financial impact. So it should be aligning to the overall risk management portfolio within any enterprise. So when you look at cybersecurity, any organization will apply, a finite budget to that cybersecurity program. And in a way that the organization needs to assess based on its risk level, based on its organizational risk management policy, and then applying the resources to the highest critical area that's been impacted. So if you look at the whole overall zero trust concept, zero trust is looking at making sure that people are accessing to the information that they're supposed to access and be able to monitor. But then at the same time, that besides monitoring those individuals, there also needs to be the necessary policy associated with it. There also needs to be people training associated with it. And people also need to understand if they're not following the necessary cybersecurity policy, but there's ramifications to their personnel files or to their career. And by having the three tools in place, then organization can start talking about maturing the zero trust concept. But the overall concept of zero trust is really just helping to mature the overall cybersecurity environment within any IT organization.
So there's a couple of things in there that I want to ask you a little bit more, and that would be around, so let's focus on the policy for a second. So definitely hear what you're saying about have a policy, you got to follow it. But what I've sort of heard from the interviews I've conducted, also working in the field historically, is create this policy, get all these people working, it looks amazing, and then it just no one thinks about it then after that. So how do you ensure people are actually staying the course on the policy? Because at the end of the day, if you want to look at, you know, there's laws in our world, whether in the United States or Australia, and people still don't follow it. So that's an actual legal ramification. So a policy, smolacy, sometimes people like to think about. So how do you sort of enforce it a little bit more? Because some of these policies, they go on for days or years. So how could someone really wrap their head around it, enforce it, and then make sure their employees are staying on track with the policy? How do you handle that?
So that's a really good question, especially for CIO CISOs. The CIO and CISOs are typically the one that's responsible to shore up the cybersecurity practice within any IT environment. So I'll give you one example. So when I was a CIO at Department of Housing and Urban Development, we have this requirement. Why I push out this requirement that I need to make sure that everybody within the agency is trained. So there are 8,000 people plus another 2,000 contractors. But they need to be, I need to make sure that we find ways to train them through a cybersecurity training, right? Vision training as well as annual cybersecurity awareness training. And how do I enforce that? There are a lot of people, they decided not to take the course. So what I did, I actually communicated prior. I talked to my leadership. I talked to my agency head. I said, this is what we do on an annual basis. And what I need to do is that for individuals that do not follow the requirement of completing the annual training, first of all, I'll give them, you know, 1 month leeway. But within that 1 month duration, the supervisor will be notified. HR and supervisor will be notified. And then after that month, that person will be off the network. We will give that person plenty of opportunity down the road to complete the training. But part of the agreement is that if the person doesn't complete the training by a specific date, the person would not be allowed to be on the network. We will disable that person's network access. We will disable that person's communication mechanism. Our person needs to communicate back to make sure that he's finding a way. Obviously, we can coordinate with the person to make sure that he has access to the course and be able to complete the course. Then once he completes the course, he'll be allowed to come back to the network. So when you say that, you know, how do you enforce that, right? How do you enforce the policy? The policy as small as just completing training, it creates a lot of impact to the organization. For U.S. government, there is an audit implication. We get audited on an annual basis, and completing cybersecurity training is one of the audit areas. It's actually the easiest to meet, but at the same time, a lot of people do not accomplish it. So in order to accomplish 100% of compliance, I need to kick people off the network. So that's the first part. The second part is that by having the necessary communication, not only to the leadership, right? For example, to the board of directors, having the board of directors to understand the ramification, but then also making sure that HR is part of the process. HR is educated, understanding that this is actually need to be ingrained as part of the culture change. We talk about process and people. That's basically form the overall culture. So for any environment that currently does not have that in practice in terms of following the policy, that environment needs to change, and somebody needs to take up the fight, right? So it's just that I was the dummy that took up the fight and really pushed through and put my job on the line, even pushing back against other offices, saying that this is a must. But I can also explain from the risk management standpoint the necessity of completing such training.
Okay, that's really interesting. So I have a few more questions on that question. Now, you mentioned before about the training. Now, I totally hear what you're saying, but I'll give you an example and then I'm keen to hear your thoughts. So back in the day, I did a CPR course, but if someone out my window now were to drop dead and like, okay, KB, go rescue them, I'd have no clue. I've done the training, I've got the certification, but I actually have no clue on how to save that person. Do you think that sort of mentality applies to the training that people are doing in their organization? Once a year, before the audit comes up, you know, we're all okay. Do you think there's a little bit of that in there? But if push comes to shove, and it, just say it's out of the annual cycle, how confident would you have been, or are you as an executive, that people will be able to potentially, you know, save the person on the street that needs CPR, for example? So do you think there's that mentality in there, or?
Yeah, so the training aspect, I mean, first of all, that's an example. And second, it's really looking at, there are actually ways to reinforce the learning from the training. So for example, you know, having periodic efficient exercises that we push out on top of the training that we're given out, right? And also making sure that the training is actually something easy to understand, and added to the training that there is a cybersecurity campaign. We actually develop a series of videos talking about cybersecurity, talking about the posture, the cybersecurity posture within the agency, talking about the deployments of capability, policy, as well as some of the cultural changes that we pushed out. But then at the same time, that what are some of the requirements in a short snippet? Like we have like a series of four videos. Each one is no more than two minutes. I actually have one of the video on my LinkedIn, just something that's very easy to understand, but then helping to reinforce the concept that this is everybody's job, right? You could be an accountant, you could be IT specialist. But on top of that, ensuring that you're safeguarding the public records, the records of the customers, or the records of the citizens. Those are actually very critical as part of the overall job. And then we also work with HR to make sure that that's being enforced. There are capability that we actually launch within using technology solutions, data loss prevention, to ensure that, you know, within US, the privacy information is critical. There was a series of privacy data breach back in 2010-ish. And because of that, it becomes a way that the CIO, the CISO, needs to tackle the issues. So we use some of the technology to help circumvent, you know, some of the unintentional sharing of information. But then by tracking those information, we're able to go back to talk to the employee to make sure that we have some sort of reinforcement training with those individuals that actually send social security number without encryption. So there are actually ways besides campaign, besides annual trainings, there are also on the job capabilities that we can use technology to supplement to make sure that we provide opportunity training for those individuals.
Just going back to the policy side of things for a second. So you mentioned before, like as a CISO, CIO, executive, it's your job to monitor that and know it. So would you say that there are people out there, and this isn't a blame game, this is just me being curious, that I don't know, someone comes in, they audit and they say, all right, David, like section 17.3, talk to me about it. Do you think that there are definitely gray areas of a policy in an organization that perhaps a CISO or a CIO don't really have the answers to, don't really have a solution to, probably are overwhelmed by it? Is there that in there? And then how can companies start to then move the needle on that? Because, I mean, at the end of the day, there's a lot of stuff going on in there. So we can't really expect that everyone, you know, someone comes in and asks you section 17.3, you're going to have all the answers detailed. That's probably going to be an element of, oh, okay, we've got to work on that. But how confident or not confident are you when it comes to this for people that are in these positions? Because technically, at the end of the day, that's your responsibility in that job.
So there are two aspects, two answers to your question. So the first part is that I look at the audit, the annual audit, as an opportunity for me to shore up my environment, right? So first of all, I'm creating the baseline, having the auditor to be able to come in to provide me a unbiased information, unbiased assessment of my cybersecurity environment. But that's something that I really appreciate. I know there are at times that people have adversarial relationship with auditors, but to me, I actually take a different approach. I see that as a way for me to communicate to the board or communicate to my agency head so that I can actually find ways to obtain additional funding, or I can actually get the attention from the leadership that this is the area I need to shore up. So for example, like when I was managing over the overall IT environment within HUD, we had our cybersecurity environment was basically non-existent. So in order to establish that, I had to use the audit report generated from the past 10 years. and aggregate those reports and present that information as well as the impact to any IT environment, but I don't start addressing those areas. So I was able to request and divert funding to make sure that I start establishing the program. And then on a yearly basis, when I meet with the auditors, I actually tell them that I believe that this is my weak area. Can you please look into it? So I actually partner with the auditors so that I ask them to help me to look at areas that I want to focus on. I want to be able to obtain funding or start gaining the attention from the board or from the agency head. Because auditors, they're paid to find findings. And in a way that why not, you know, work together to find the findings that can actually help the organization. So that's the first part, right? The second part is that to your question. So going back to when I was the CIO at HUD, we had a total of 186 legacy applications. Within those 186 legacy applications, each application was developed either by the program offices or not going through a centralized method of development. And that's actually stemmed in the past 30 years. So me being a CIO, I started the job after 1 year. I'm not going to be able to fix all the issues in one setting. And those are actually critical issues. That's actually the identity access management control, which is critical to part of Zero Trust. And I can tell you that by the time I left HUD, we're still struggling with that particular issue, right? I'll be very honest, right? I mean, that's, you're talking about a massive application portfolio. That needs to be normalized. That needs to be normalized from the central architecture standpoint. Each application has its way of user access management. Each application also has different set of data, different type of data that hasn't gone through data classification. So the first part is that going through the inventory of 186, that in itself was a difficult matter because there's so many out there. And what do they do, defining what they do, what kind of data that they access, who actually needs to have what data. Those are a very difficult planning aspect, which took a long time. And then once we have that defined, then what is the common solution that we can leverage to make sure that we're centralizing that? At the same time that I'm still servicing these offices, these programs to make sure that I'm not taking their system down. So I had to go through pilot of projects and then start to group them in different manners and started to create a roadmap as well as different phases. And that's a monumental effort besides, you know, the overall spending on getting those applications centralized and normalized, as well as creating one central way of accessing or a few central way of accessing the information and managing over the identity access. That is, I would say that, you know, how would I be able to undo 30 years of legacy application within the matter of 2-3 years? I mean, that's the hard part, right? So, you know, by the time I left, the organization is still going through the same exercise because it's just something that people need to consciously finding ways to centralize that component. And it goes back to the risk in IT. So we talked about, you know, this conversation is about Zero Trust. If we do not have ways to identify who's accessing what data, whether this person has the legitimate reason to access that particular data set and what they do with it, if we don't have a way to monitor, it's very difficult to identify all the risks within the environment, the cyber risks within the environment. So going back to your question, you're asking, are there times that there are just unknown that the CIO and CISO are just not be able to resolve them all? Absolutely, right? I'm not God. I mean, we're not. I mean, we're just trying to, you know, make ends meet, try to make sure that we're prioritizing and finding ways to make sure that we reduce the overall risk within the environment.
Yeah, thanks for sharing that. And you're absolutely right. You know, that's a big job for an 86 legacy applications. Like, of course, you won't be able to accomplish that. Do you think that an auditor thinks you're God, though? Their job is to find holes.
There's always areas that need to improve upon. I think initially they're looking at, you know, some of the application controls, some of the data controls. They're also looking at maturity from the FISMA standpoint. They're also looking at different ways that we're showing up with data loss prevention. So there's always ways that you can, being an auditor, they can always find ways. They know their rule book. They know the NIST guideline left like back of their hands. So they're able to find ways. But for me, I think, you know, rather than pushing back or being adversarial, I need to get that done anyway. And from on a yearly basis, why not partner? Why not partner up and volunteer some of the issues and then finding ways to have a strengthened rapport so that I can get my board, I can get my agency head to be able to see and then be able to help me to resolve those issues.
So I want to switch gears now, and I want to focus on the impact Zero Trust has on a company, culture and employee retention. But I want to start with, how do we measure impact, though, like with culture? Because when you think about it, like, what does that look like? Because, you know, people have different versions in their mind, whether it's, oh, we have beer on tap or we have ping pong tables or whatever. Now, everyone's got their view on that. But, you know, how can people sort of measure culture when it comes to zero trust?
So I think just the name itself, Zero Trust, it would actually bring, you know, culturally, I think people would actually think about it as a way that, you know, so you're doing all this exercise because you don't trust me, or you're trying to implement this procedure and policy because, or technology, because you don't trust me as a worker within the environment. And that's absolutely untrue, but it does require, you know, information campaign. It does require conversation with employees. It does require that at times that it may be creating some inconvenience to the user, that they need to certify, they need to be who they basically need to be who they say they are. So within the Zero Trust pillar, identity pillar, from the Biden administration executive order, it talks about multi-factor authentication, right? So I think a lot of people are currently used to multi-factor authentication, essentially that, you know, you can use your smartphone, right? Register your smartphone. When you try to log in with your login ID and password, and then they'll come back to send a number, right? A PIN, a generated PIN, so that you enter it and you use that as a multi-factor authentication. So that's one way of multi-factor authentication, but it's a requirement that's part of the Zero Trust because people have their phones with them all the time. They should be able to enter that PIN number. If they're not able to enter the PIN number, then they don't live in the 21st century. So the bottom line is that's where initially when this concept of multi-factor authentication was first pushed out, it created a lot of resistance. And then when people start adopting, when this becomes more of a commercial focus, because initially there's actually a lot of US government agency requiring multi-factor authentication, especially in the military, where you have your personal identifier verification card, you put in there and you type in your PIN number, and that actually serves as multi-factor authentication because the car actually have your biometrics. But when people actually starting to get used to on their daily lives, then this becomes easier. But it does require some communication, some marketing campaign, as well as letting people know that we're pushing out Zero Trust is really helping to protect the overall valuable assets, IT assets within the enterprise. Just like, you know, if you have intellectual properties, you will lock it, right? Any organization will actually lock it in the vault. And also you want to secure it to make sure there's only certain people that have access to the intellectual property. Then why are we not doing that the same way that we're treating data? So a lot of the cases, data is actually similar to intellectual property. Those are valuable. Either it's a differentiator for people to do business, or potentially that it's actually the requirement for people to safeguard those privacy data. So to me, it's a matter of just, you know, really helping the enterprise to understand, the employees to understand that, yeah, this is actually, we're doing this for the sake of helping the enterprise to mitigate risk and reduce overall risk.
So why aren't people doing that? Do you think they still just don't know, or they're confused, or there's not enough maturation in the space?
Yeah, people are confused. People are curious. People are complacent. So if you're doing business for the past 30 years, you do it the same way. Just like I took over Department of Housing and Urban Development. For 30 years, people are using the environment, using the IT system the same way. And now you're telling me that I have to change my approach because you want to enhance the overall cyber risk posture. How does cyber risk posture posture impact my daily life. So before I could send out, I could communicate directly to public about social security number, about validating this person with social security number, with their phone number, with their name. But now you're saying that I need to encrypt that. But if I were to encrypt that, it's going to create more pain for me. So I think a lot of time that people are complacent, but it goes back to this educational aspect, right? So first you take the softer approach. We make sure that everybody's educated. And then later on, once the environment has become a little more mature, then you start enforcing, finding the IT solution to be able to enforce it. But then as well as making sure that this is actually part of the employee appraisal, that they also need to safeguard the privacy data. So typically that for organization that has gone through privacy breaches, those organizations would change their culture. You know, we all know that the public outcry, the flocking by the public, as well as by government, the penalty that's imposed by the government, the issue with the overall reputational risk, that would prompt any organization to change its culture, right? So it becomes something that's enforced top down, but then people at the lower level, they would also start to understand, so how this is relevant to my job, how this is becoming an issue to my job. And they, for those organizations, they tend to do much better down the road in terms of protecting those privacy data.
So in terms of complacency, totally hear what you're saying. From a mindset perspective, I would expect a junior, lower level employee to think complacent. But if you're an executive or you're in a leadership role, like, I understand how that's annoying. No one wants to do stuff they don't have to, but that's kind of your job. Like, we've all been forced to get our backs against the wall and go, we've got to move now. So I think that I get it, but then I kind of don't get it. That's your job, to ensure that the business moves forward in terms of it's still profitable, in terms that it's still safe, whether you're regulated or not regulated industry. So what are your sort of sentiments on that? And I guess understanding that, of course, people hate change, I get that, but kind of just doesn't make sense if you're a leader then.
Yeah, I'm smiling because there's an example I want to give you that actually speaks directly to that. So I'm not going to say which agency that I worked at actually that this occurred, but you can guess by looking at my LinkedIn profile. So I was a senior leader within the organization. Let me put it that way. So you wouldn't guess which agency this is. And we actually push out a phishing exercise. We sent it to everybody within the agency. And the phishing exercise was that the title was, see your fellow coworkers, what they do in the lunchroom by click on this link. We set up a camera in the lunchroom for you to see what they're doing during lunch hour. So the executive director and the deputy executive director clicked on the link. So I had my one-on-one and I was like, dude, why did you click on the link? You knew that this was phishing. Their response was that, oh, we knew that, you know, it was phishing, but, you know, we're actually curious of what people are doing in the lunchroom. And we know that the bottom line is that you're in IT, you're in charge of IT. So we click on it, something happened, you'll be able to take care of it. That was the mindset, right? I mean, you talked about the question that you asked me, you talked about executive. These two people are the highest level of that organization and they clicked on it, right? So I think at times that it goes back to the organizational assessment on the risk management. If you really look at it, who are the highest value people to be targeted? It's actually the board member within any enterprises. The highest level, the higher level that you are, the more value that the attackers would actually get if they are able to attack you, or, you know, if they're able to isolate you and finding ways to have you to click on links or have you to essentially compromise yourself. A lot of time it's unintentional, but because these people are also think that they're above everything else, or somebody's going to help them to take care of any particular issue. So at times that they're not as aware of this, that they're actually being the highest target value. So, you know, that's something that any organization needs to change, right? Making sure that there is a conversation going on at the board level, at the agency head level, letting them know that they're actually at the highest level of attack. People would love to get them to click on links because it's easy. It's easy. They're easy prey in that sense, and they provide a lot of value.
So you think that mindset will shift? Because we can't have people doing that, because that's how exact issues start.
People tend to learn through mistakes, right? So that's one way. And so if somebody made a mistake, something happened, this became a public news that, you know, the executive director is actually click on this link, and it led to the ransomware, it led to something really bad happened to the organization, then people will get noticed, right? But typically you're talking about executive individuals that probably have the absolute power within the organization. I'm going through a Harvard business course, and we talk about the responsibility for the board members. So I think cybersecurity is actually one key area for the board members to understand, to have at least some basic understanding, as well as understanding that they're the highest value and that's targeted and being targeted. And what they need to do is that they need to be always careful in terms of overall communication and align with the cybersecurity experts within any enterprises. So I think that should be something that's required to be a training capability. Or, you know, I know a lot of time when I came here, you talked about different business. We talked about cyber insurance or physios. So this could be another business that you have education fully dedicated for board members on cybersecurity.
Well, I guess time will tell. We'll see what happens with, you know, the maturation of the responsibility for board members and how that changes, whether that is, you know, for regulated or non-regulated industries. So in terms of any sort of final thoughts or closing comments, David, is there anything specifically you'd like to leave our audience with today?
So I mentioned a little bit about the executive order from US that was published in March on the National Cybersecurity Plan. And one of the area actually talks about forcing the software developers to really emphasize on developing better softwares before it's been launched. So this is actually something that we talked about in the past in terms of not putting all eggs in one basket, right? Even though there's a lot of vendor consolidation, even though people are using, you know, various companies using their security capabilities. But, you know, we talked about cybersecurity as risk management. And as far as the risk management, you know, why would you focus a lot of your risk within one vendor or within selective vendor? So I think that's something that I know in the US, there has been some congressional inquiries on some of the major software developers on their practice in terms of producing softwares. That's not the most efficient or the most effective software in terms of protecting cyber. And yet they're also profiting from creating cybersecurity services, as well as providing cybersecurity software as part of the bundle. So I think that's one key area that people need to really focus on, that the from globally, right, at least from the US government, that there has been a lot of attention paid in that area in the past couple of years, especially with this specific executive order.
Well, thanks for that, David. And thanks for being honest in your answers, because part of the show is to not be airy-fairy and fluffy. Like, I want to give people tangible insights that they can think about, speak to you about, or, you know, start implementing today. So I genuinely do appreciate your time. I know that you're a busy person, and I, you know, really enjoyed today's conversation. So thanks so much for coming on the show.
Yeah, really appreciate it. This is always like to have conversation with you. I know we had a good conversation last time, and hopefully that we'll continue to talk in the future as well.
Thanks for tuning in. We hope that you found today's episode useful and you took away a few key points. Don't forget to subscribe to our podcast to get our latest episodes.
This podcast is brought to you by MercSec, the specialists in security, search, and recruitment solutions. Visit MercSec.com to connect today.
If you'd like to find out how KBI can help grow your cyber business, then please head over to kbi.digital.
This podcast was brought to you by KBI.media, the voice of cyber.